This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Bad news about New England's cod fishery is nothing new, but the situation has taken on a new urgency in the past few years. In 2012, fishery managers slashed the amount of Gulf of Maine cod fishermen were allowed to catch by almost 80%. The decision was based on a comprehensive assessment of the health of the cod population that concluded the iconic fish wasn't recovering from decades of fishing as quickly as hoped. Those reductions cut deep into the wallets of cod fishermen and fishing communities around New England. As a result, the federal government declared a fishery disaster, and earlier this year issued $32.8 million in disaster relief funds to assist affected fishermen. Unfortunately, it appears that none of this has helped the cod. A new report from scientists at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, quote, presents a grim picture for the potential recovery of this iconic fish stock. The results indicate virtually every indicator of stock condition declined or worsened in 2013. Again, that's a direct quote. The number of reproductively active cod have hit an all-time low, at a mere 3-4% of what's needed for a strong, sustainable fishery. That's down steeply from an estimated 13-18% just a couple of years ago. The report is preliminary, but if it's accepted, additional fishing restrictions seem inevitable. It's even possible that the Gulf of Maine cod fishery could be closed. This wouldn't be the first time an Atlantic cod fishery has collapsed. In 1992, Canada closed its fabled cod fisheries off the coasts of Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. They remain largely closed to this day. Canadian fishery biologist Dr. George Rose says what's going on in the Gulf of Maine is eerily familiar.
The decline was so rapid that it really took everybody off guard. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, even all these years later, we really don't have the perfect explanation about what really happened.
Later this hour, we'll talk with Dr. George Rose and get his take on whether Gulf of Maine cod is going the way of their cousins to the north. But the history of cod fishing and overfishing in the Atlantic stretches back much further than the 1980s or 90s. In fact, historian and author Jeffrey Bolster argues that depleted stocks are what led European cod fishermen to our shores in the first place, some 400 years ago. Dr. Jeffrey Bolster is Associate Professor of History and Co-Director of the Center for History of Marine Animal Populations at University of New Hampshire. He's written about topics ranging from African-American seamen in the age of sail to the role of shipping in the making of America. His most recent book is titled The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. It chronicles a millennium of overfishing and fishing regulations, first off Europe's coasts and then here in the New World. Professor Bolster, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks, Heather. Nice to be here.
The history of marine animal populations, that is not a center title that you hear all the time. What do you see being the importance of a historical perspective in addressing ecological issues?
Oh, I think, Heather, that without historical understandings, we can have no idea of the magnitude of the restoration challenges we face. In other words, if one's timeline for restoration is only 6 years or 8 years or 10 years, and you look back a certain time with a very short data set, that becomes a very short-term political goal for restoration rather than an ecologically appropriate goal, perhaps, for restoration.
How do you actually go about estimating things like catch amounts and stock levels from hundreds of years ago when there was really no means of doing that at the time?
Our group here at the University of New Hampshire, a group that consists of historians, ecologists, and biostatisticians, actually pioneered some methodologies, which are a small part of my book. But our group published a paper some years ago about modeling cod biomass using historical data. In a nutshell, we found a run of very accurate fishing records from the 1850s and 60s, all compiled by American fishermen who were fishing on the Nova Scotian shelf. There were hundreds of logbooks with annotations as well in each logbook about other vessels that they had spoken and what their reported catches were. But each logbook gives for each day of a fishing season, an entire summer, where the vessel was, the depth of water it was in, how many men were fishing, how many codfish they were catching, and then the total weight of the entire trip, which gives you the average weight per fish. And so, you know, it's as if you had a satellite camera suspended over the Nova Scotian shelf in the 1850s. We could tell you where all these different boats were and what they were catching. So you take that data, which is very difficult to manage, but you take that data, and the data is clean for a variety of reasons. There was no incentive to fudge it. Men got paid by the number of fish they were catching individually. The boat got paid by the weight of the trip. The government bounty was paid by the tonnage of the vessel. So there's no fudging. And so it's good, clean data. But then you have to marry it with contemporary population modeling methods, the sort of ones that sort of techniques that fishery scientists use today to try to estimate populations of fish, and their biologists use these for other organisms as well. So that was the that was really the signature accomplishment of our interdisciplinary group, was to use historical data and contemporary population modeling methods to create estimates of cod biomass in fished areas in the past, much farther back than there had been estimates previously available. So we understand more what the state of the fishery was like, let's say, around the American Civil War.
Obviously, your book goes back much further than 1850s, and you say in the introduction to The Mortal Sea that you really felt it was important to recast the ocean as a player in history, as a character in history, rather than a setting for history to take place. What do you mean by that? How do you make the ocean a player?
Oh, the ocean has been very much a player. You know, mythologically, we sort of imagine the ocean was just this barrier to be crossed so that we could settle Plymouth or Boston or settle Quebec and then start the New World. The real story there is the rise of new nations in a new world. But if you go back to how people in the 16th and 17th century imagined it, for the most part, you know, for well over 100 years before there was any settlement in North America, permanent settlement, Europeans came every season to fish. They came to collect codfish and whales, to process them, to return, with no idea of starting new countries or, you know, free ideas about freedom of religion. They were simply out in the fringes of the Western Ocean to catch fish. So I think that if we look at the Atlantic Ocean as a complicated ecological system, as a treasure house, as the way it was imagined in different periods by different times, it becomes a player in the drama. Quite simply, the discovery of America hinged on the depletion of European seas. And the first people that came here were fishermen and whalers, and the reason they came across the North Atlantic in stormy February and March was simply because they had already exhausted the grounds close to home. With the technology available to them, they could no longer make the catches they wanted or needed of whales and cod and other species in European waters, and they sailed across the tempestuous North Atlantic. That should get our attention.
I mean, that really is, that's quite a feat, especially several hundred years ago. We now traverse the Atlantic by plane all the time and really think nothing of it. But to, as you said, make that trip across the ocean, especially in winter, in rough seas, in the North Atlantic, very cold, very rough seas, this was extremely treacherous. The fishermen must have been extremely driven. How great was the reward that they faced when they returned to Europe with fish from around Cape Cod and around New England?
Oh, you know, you could make good trips here. If you could get your ship across the Western Ocean, as they called it, they didn't really call it the Atlantic for a long time, but you get across the Western Ocean in February and March, and you set up your temporary fishing camp on the south shore of Newfoundland or parts of Nova Scotia or later in the Gulf of Maine, like the Isles of Shoals or Monhegan, and you fish for the season, and then you go home again in the fall, hopefully before the hurricane season. You could catch so many fish here that you could make a good trip of it. Now, obviously, the hardships, you know, by our scale are off the chart. But the real point is that this was an ecosystem with which Europeans were very familiar. It was dramatically the same. In other words, when Europeans went to the Philippines or the Caribbean, they saw all these bizarre fish and weird organisms, and it was exotic. But when they came to Newfoundland or the Gulf of Maine, ho-hum, same old stuff. Oh, they got herring, they got salmon, they've got eider ducks, there's harbor seals, codfish, but there was more of everything. That's what got their attention.
Yeah, you in the book talk about all of these accounts of early explorers just talking about the incredible abundance of a variety of things, and one that really caught my attention was walruses, that there apparently used to be large walrus populations off the coast of North America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the breeding walrus populations were as far south as Nova Scotia. We today imagine walrus as an Arctic species because the remnant walrus population today lives in the Arctic. But when Europeans first arrived, there were large walrus populations breeding in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, on the south shore of Newfoundland, and on islands off of Nova Scotia. So that is an example of range contraction, where an organism that was hunted seriously was not exterminated, but its distribution or its range was reduced considerably because of human hunting pressure.
You mentioned, Professor Bolster, the fact that it wasn't for some time that the Atlantic came to actually be called the Atlantic. For a long time, it was called the Western Ocean. And in The Mortal Sea, you make this interesting point that, of course, calling it the Atlantic implies suddenly the dawning of an understanding that there are multiple oceans and a completely different global geography than had been previously understood. When did that awareness really come about?
Oh, you know, there, European seamen were aware, certainly, of lots of oceans. We name oceans right now in a way that we think is normalized to the extent that we sort of assume it's always been this way. And when you talk about the Atlantic as a separation between the Old World and the New World, it reinforces that the real story there is the rise of new nations in the New World. People at the time, though, certainly in the 1500s and the early 1600s, throughout the 1600s, they didn't necessarily see it that way. So the Atlantic was not named as the Atlantic until that was used commonly by the 18th century, the 1700s. But prior to that, it was sort of seen as the Great Ocean Sea, the Western Ocean, and people just went to the extremity of it to fish. So the imaginations of, let's say, some English fishermen in the 1500s were that you could fish off Lancashire, that's the west coast of England, sort of in the Irish Sea, or you could sail across Newfoundland and fish, and it was all sort of the same thing. That's a really different perspective than modern Americans or Canadians who imagine that everyone was focused on getting across the Atlantic Ocean to the New World. So by changing the way the story has been told, in effect by me going back to honor the perspective of people at that time, how they saw what they were doing, what we see is that the boreal North Atlantic, North Atlantic between the Gulf Stream on the south border and the Arctic on the north border, that boreal North Atlantic ecosystem that stretches from Cape Cod to Newfoundland here and across the North Atlantic and then from the English Channel up to Norway, it was just all one piece of ocean that had all very similar organisms and similar range of temperature. But in Europe, it had been fished hard for 1,000 years, and that was not the case in America. And so when people came here, just the edge of the Western Ocean, they found a very familiar place that was just full of fish. In effect, they were seeing what the Eastern Atlantic, the European Ocean, had looked like probably several thousand years before the Neolithic Revolution, when people shifted from hunter-gathering to settled communities. So that reframes the story. What I really tried to do is I argued that this first generation of explorers has never really been understood because the accounts they left have never been presented in light of what was normal for them, what was their baseline when they left Europe. Number one, all the species were the same. Number two, these guys were very, very perceptive. To be a mariner in that age, you had to be perceptive or you died. They paid attention to their surroundings. And number three, following all these very similar species when they got to the Americas, it's like, holy smokes, look at the abundance. So it wasn't a new world. It was just an extension of the old world, the boreal North Atlantic marine ecosystem, that had not yet been harvested.
Well, I think we've typically had this perception that some of those early fishermen and early explorers of this part of the world were kind of blissfully ignorant, thinking that the ocean was enormous and limitless and could be fished at any, you know, at any amount without any impact on the ocean. And you say that, in fact, that wasn't their perception of the situation at all, that especially by the time you get to having actual colonies here in New England, New Plymouth and Mass Bay colonies, some of their earliest laws were actually laws aimed at conserving what they saw as limited or perhaps even endangered marine resources.
Yeah, Heather, that was one of the most striking things to come out of this book. It turns out that from the 1630s until about 1705, here in New England, specifically the Plymouth Colony and then the Massachusetts Bay Colony and then later the Connecticut colonies as well, during those years, basically the 1600s, when the European population here in New England, from Kittery, Maine to Norwalk, Connecticut, was pretty thin, tens of thousands at the most as the time went on. The magistrates, the men in charge, the government, passed a series of laws, not just one law, but many laws to conserve fish, laws against using striped bass to manure fields because it was wasteful, laws not to catch cod and haddock and pollock in their spawning seasons, laws to prevent overfishing of mackerel in their spawning seasons, laws to prevent the overfishing of the anadromous fish such as alewives and shad and salmon that came up the rivers to spawn. So what was quite remarkable to me, it was actually stunning, is that here in this marine dreamscape lapping at their feet, this system in which the shoals of silvery mackerel went on forever, in which any boy could pick up as many lobsters as he wanted, in which the right whales came in right to the beach, from the 1630s to 1705, in a variety of laws, the magistrates in these New England colonies tried to conserve those marine resources. That says to me that that first generation coming from Europe was conscious of what had happened in these European ecosystems, and they recognized that depletions could occur, certainly of the river fish, and they took measures to conserve fish for the future.
They were taking measures to try to conserve it, and yet we still saw the extinction of Atlantic salmon, the devastation of many different species during this time, marine mammal populations, fish populations. It really, to me at least, begs the question of whether we are capable of restraining ourselves to a point that we can actually sustainably harvest the ocean.
Yeah, Heather, the historical record of 400 years would provide an emphatic no to your question. In the last 20 years, I think we're moving in the right direction, certainly. New England fishermen, for the most part, still think of 1992 as about the low point. That means that in the last 20 years, things have begun to rebound. Obviously, this year we've had a huge setback with the estimates of cod and the closures that you talked about in the intro to the show. There's also been a big restriction in the Gulf of Maine shrimp season this year. So by no means are we entirely out of the woods. But what the historical record shows, unfortunately, the tragedy at the heart of this book, is that we, just the United States and Eastern Canada, have been having the same discussions for 160 years, discussions about depletion, discussions about diminution, and discussions about what regulations should be in place to slow down that process and to preserve fish for the future. So for 160 years, since basically the time of the Civil War before, these discussions have raged. Now, people have changed sides at different times, and some decades the fishermen have said, we got a real problem, and the scientists said, no, it's fine, nature works in inscrutable ways, just keep fishing. And then more recently, fishermen have said, everything's fine, what do you mean? And scientists said, oh, we got a problem. So the protagonists have occasionally switched camps, and I can go into that if you want, but the real point is that the conversation has been the same since prior to the American Civil War, where certain knowledgeable Americans, at that time it was all fishermen, said, we got a problem, stocks are going down, catches are going down, you, the government, our elected representatives, must do something to take care of this. So this discussion begins in the 1850s, and that, I think, is another sort of stunning revelation of this book. This discussion has not just gone on, let's say, since 1976 with the imposition of the Magnuson-Stevens Act or something else.
That's historian and author Jeff Bolster. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll hear more from Professor Bolster in a few minutes. As we're considering the history and future of New England's cod fishery, though, we also want to hear from you. What would be lost if the Gulf of Maine cod fishery closed? Jobs, obviously, perhaps a local food source, but would we lose something deeper, part of our shared heritage and identity, if the fish for whom Cape Cod is named, the fish whose likeness hangs in the Massachusetts State House, if cod were no longer being fished in New England's waters? Tweet your thoughts to Living Lab Radio or leave us a comment on Facebook. Living Lab's historical perspective on Atlantic cod continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Today, we're considering both the history and the future of New England's iconic cod fisheries. A recent report has raised the possibility that it may be necessary to close the Gulf of Maine to cod fishing, and that has brought tensions between fishermen and fishery managers to a head. Historian Jeffrey Bolster of the University of New Hampshire has chronicled not only the spread of cod fishing across the Atlantic, but also the development of fishery science and management here in New England. He's the author of The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. you talk a little bit in the book about the founding of the first U.S. Commission on Fish and Fisheries, which was founded in 1871 and you know, has a real connection here to Woods Hole. Spencer Baird started the Fish Commission, was the first fish commissioner, and he really felt that basic research, basic oceanographic research, was fundamentally important to addressing the challenges of trying to manage fisheries. He started what has now become the Northeast Fishery Science Center here in Woods Hole. But you were talking about this kind of flip-flop in the conversation between scientists and fishermen. And it's interesting that you write that really there was, almost from the very beginning of any sort of official government regulation from the founding of this fish commission, there was already a real divide between people like Spencer Baird, who thought that research was essential, and others who thought that some of this research was really a waste of time. And that has really over time developed into a fairly unbridgeable divide between fishermen and fishery scientists.
Yeah, Heather, I wouldn't quite put it like that. I mean, certainly recently there has been what appeared to be an unbridgeable divide since the 70s. But in the 1870s, the century before that, it wasn't like Americans were saying that what the Fish Commission research was doing was a waste. In fact, fishermen were delighted because the U.S. Fish Commission, for the first half of its existence, from about 1870 through the 1930s, was right pulling along with fishermen, trying to develop better technology to fish, trying to develop more basic biology to understand the movements and migrations of fish. The Fish Commission and fishermen worked together for 60 or 70 years. Very closely, and the Fish Commission saw that its raison d'etre was not just to do fundamental research, but was to have an applied economic basis, an economic ichthyology, they called it, to help fishermen fish better. So there was no animosity between scientists and fishermen at the time, other than fishermen were skeptical from the 1850s to the 1930s. Fishermen were very skeptical when Fish Commission naturalists and scientists then said, oh, everything will be all right. Nature works in inscrutable ways. There will be plenty of fish. It's just sort of a short-term blip that has led to these decreases. Fishermen at the time in Maine and Massachusetts and Nova Scotia were not on board with that. But it is important to point out that it was Spencer Baird in the early 1870s, 1873, who talked about the need for the restoration of our exhausted cod fisheries. That was 1873, not 1973.
I mean, you're very careful in the book to make the point that you don't think that current or past problems with overfishing are something that you can kind of point a finger and lay blame just on fishermen or just on regulations that weren't framed correctly, or you can't lay the blame on any one person or party. That part of the problem really just comes down to an inherent difference between the time scale and the geographic scale of ocean ecosystems and of human communities. And this can really lead to a phenomenon that's come to be called shifting baselines. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Oh, shifting baselines, in effect, goes like this. It says that each generation comes on the scene, whether that generation, in this case, is a marine scientist or a fisherman. They get raised in their communities, and they become young men or women going out to do their work, typically in their 20s. And they look around, and sort of what they see, they sort of assume is normal. Because, you know, as kids growing up, whatever neighborhood you live in, you assume that's normal. You grow up in a certain political system, you sort of assume that's normal. So people come of age, whether they're, in this case, scientists or fishermen, and they see what they're confronting, and they sort of assume that's normal. And then for them, it's the change over their own lifetime that becomes most important or most significant, and they refer to changes since they were first on the scene, whether doing their field work or fishing or whatever. So what this is, and it's a very human attribute, it's a very normal kind of human way to perceive the world. What it ignores, though, what it suspends attention to, is all the changes that occurred in the system prior to you or me or Mr. or Ms. Scientist Fisherman arriving on the scene. And so the shifting baseline system points out that, for instance, in the 1850s and 1860s, when fishermen in Maine and Massachusetts were desperately convinced that something was wrong and that they were catching fewer and fewer true sea fish, not river fish, but true sea fish, and in the 1850s and 60s, they implored their congressmen and their legislators to do something about it. The point is that it's not like they were first on the scene. People have been fishing these waters for 350 years. And, you know, if you look at the statistics of cod landings in my book, it's actually rather stunning, and it goes very quickly like this. 1861, the first year of the Civil War, 70,000 metric tons of cod landed in the Gulf of Maine. A decade later, about 66,000 tons. 2 decades after that, about 54,000 tons. This is still all a hook fishery. By the late 1880s, 1890s, it's about 26,000 tons. And that's a gill net and hook fishery. And then by the time we start with draggers, the catches are 10,000 metric tons. That's like around World War I. So you've gone from the Civil War to World War I, and the catches have gone from 70,000 metric tons, small sailboats, small rowboats, hooks, to 10,000 metric tons, steam-powered draggers. Okay, so an old fisherman today might look back to the middle of the 20th century, back to when it was good. Except by that time, the system had already been hit really, really, really hard. And so the high concept behind this book is just to reconstruct, really, from the late Middle Ages, when Europeans first arrived here, until the beginning of the dragging revolution around World War I, the changes in the ecosystem, changes in the system, changes in the fisheries prior to industrialization. That's the point. And pretty drastic changes, to tell you the truth.
You say that there have, over the course of history, typically been two responses to depleted fish stocks. You were just talking about one, this development of new technology that can allow fishermen to catch more fish even when there are fewer fish to be had. And then the other is to find new fishing grounds. Neither of those seems like a terribly workable solution for the situation we currently find ourselves in. Is there another option that you can offer based on the research that you've done?
Oh, I'm not a futurist, but you know, for centuries, as fish stocks declined, fishermen had two choices. Like you said, they either developed new gear to fish more intensively where they were, or they took the gear they had and they put it in their boats and they went to some place that had not yet been exploited. Okay, we're basically out of that game. I mean, as the Arctic ice retreats, there will be some Arctic pollock and cod revealed. And as new technologies allow us to fish even deeper and more efficiently, we can probably find the last Patagonian toothfish in the Southern Ocean. So, you know, some new technologies and expansion of fishing area will work. But going forward, the only thing that is going to lead to more fish is an attempt to restore ecosystems. Humans don't have a very good track record of engineering nature to get the outcomes they desire. Humans have a very good track record of following up nature to compromise what they need from the system. And so the challenge going forward is neither to develop new technologies to fish more intensively, we could certainly develop new technologies to fish smarter, but nor is it to go and find unexploited fishing grounds, but it's to try to create, in my estimation, closed areas, marine protected areas, sensible regulations, better gear to try to see some of these fish stocks rebound. But they've been in decline in our waters for 400 years. Not 25 years, not 30 years, not 50 years, 400 years. And so to imagine that anything we do is going to create dramatic improvements in the space of a 2 or 4 year political cycle is a little naive. This has been a problem long in the making. It's going to be a problem that's going to take a long time to resolve. But I'd like to be optimistic and say that going forward, my grandchildren or great-grandchildren could see working waterfronts in New England. You know, I was a commercial mariner for 10 years. I still have my license. I spent a lot of time at sea. Guys that go to sea are my guys, and yet we're in a fix. So going forward, can we have fish and fishermen for the future? That's the challenge.
That's historian Jeffrey Bolster of the University of New Hampshire. He's the author of The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. When cod stocks near the European coast began to decline some 500 years ago, fishermen moved on to richer waters, eventually crossing the Atlantic and launching the iconic fisheries on the Grand Banks, George's Bank, and in the Gulf of Maine. Now, as those stocks decline, there's nowhere else for fishermen to go. If the Gulf of Maine cod fishery were to close, fishermen would have to find something else to do. That's exactly the dilemma that fishermen in Newfoundland faced when their cod fishery closed in 1992. Radio producer Ari Daniel found this uplifting story of how one town moved on.
In Portugal Cove South in southern Newfoundland, there's a story of two vanished species and how people had to turn from depending on one to depending on the other.
This is the only place in the world where you lock your boat and you hang your key next to the lock.
Because it's so safe.
Yes, indeed, and it is.
Charlene Powers and her family harvested cod for generations. That is, until the fishery collapsed in the early 90s.
Right now, you can't get a fish out here to eat. There's no cod in our area.
But there used to be.
But there used to be lots of cod, yeah. It's just like it vanished.
The collapse of the fishery and the resulting moratorium on cod fishing ricocheted through this community.
Enrollment in school has declined. Supermarkets closed. People were afraid. They didn't know what was going to happen. We watched our community go downhill.
Almost half the nearly 400 residents in the area moved away and never came back.
You're losing friends. You're losing neighbors. And, I don't know, part of you is missing.
That's Kit Ward, a retired school teacher, and she was determined to keep her community intact. So she teamed up with a few friends to promote the area. Among their ideas...
A wonderful fossil site, which we knew was important.
A fossil site important both scientifically and economically. First, the science. Kit Ward was told by a couple paleontologists doing research in the area that the fossils are from the first complex animals that appeared on our planet during the Ediacaran period. That is, over half a billion years ago.
And talking to them, we saw, we only had a surface knowledge. So this could be big. Wow, and it's right here on our doorstep.
About a five-minute drive from Kit Ward's house is the Mistaken Point Ecological Reserve. This part of the Newfoundland coastline is jagged. It looks like a series of red tennis courts angling out of the water.
We are standing on a 580-million-year-old sea bottom.
Guy Narbun is a paleontologist at Queen's University in Ontario. He stoops down to point out a treasure of a fossil. It looks like a long fern frond, but it's not a plant. It's an animal that lived on the bottom of the ocean where the light couldn't penetrate.
I'm going to follow it along.
Narbun runs his finger along the length of the fossil.
And it ends right here. That's my height. We're looking at, bar none, the oldest large multicellular creature on Earth.
And these creatures are drawing a crowd. Narbun's become part of some significant economic development in the area, and he says it's as gratifying as all the science he's done here. Proof of this success is here at the nearby Trapassi Motel and Lodge. They've got 15 rooms and can seat up to 60 for meals.
We have people who come here to have our fish and chips or to have our pan-fried cod dinner.
That's Mary Devereaux, the co-owner and manager. When they first opened 20 years ago, she says most of their business came from the people connected to the fishery.
The bleakest time was immediately after the cod moratorium, when we could have shut our doors.
They managed to stay open, barely, and today business is good again. A resurgence in the fishery, this time it's crabbing, has helped. The fossils are playing a big role, too.
We often say, well, what brought you here? And 30 to 40% of the time, it's the fossils of Mistaken Point.
Besides fossil tourism, the fossils have created jobs. Informal estimates suggest about a quarter of the jobs in the area now stem directly or indirectly from the reserve. Sarah Tweet is a graduate student in paleontology at the University of Maryland. She's spent several nights at the Trapassi Motel and Lodge and has eaten more than a few meals here. This visit is her first time seeing the fossils of Mistaken Point.
Fossils are representatives of the history of life, and that's a heritage to which we all belong. Mistaken Point is a shining example of how sharing that history actively can help rebuild and support a community.
It's also an example of how the locals can give back to the scientists. That fossil that's as tall as a person, it was a local resident who found the specimen. His name is Bradley Ward, Kit Ward's son.
Oh, yes, I'm a very proud mom. Very proud mom.
In her home, she has a framed photograph of the fossil, which was given the scientific name Trapassia Wardae, in honor of the Ward family. Kit Ward smiles when she sees the inscription under the photograph. The scientists credit her family for being tireless guardians of their fossil heritage, not to mention guardians of their community's economic and civic future.
That was Ari Daniel, reporting for the Encyclopedia of Life as part of their One Species at a Time series, produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll hear from Canadian fishery biologist George Rose about the collapse of the Newfoundland cod fishery in the 1990s and whether Gulf of Maine cod appears to be heading the same way. If it is, what would that mean to you? What would we lose if cod were no longer fished in New England? Share your thoughts with Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. More in a few moments. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. A new report from scientists at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center says cod stocks in the Gulf of Maine have hit an all-time low. The question is, can they recover? Or could this be it for cod fishing in the Gulf of Maine? For some perspective on this situation, we turn to Dr. George Rose, a longtime cod researcher, formerly with the Canadian government, and now head of the Fisheries Conservation Group at Memorial University in Newfoundland. He watched Canadian cod stocks on the Grand Banks collapse in the early 90s and has studied their fate since then. He says he sees parallels between the Grand Banks in the 1990s and the Gulf of Maine today.
I haven't seen the most recent stock assessments, but I do follow the situation there a little bit, and I was aware that things were not looking very good.
To say the least. Let's go back to 20, 25 years ago. In Newfoundland, what did that decline, that kind of final decline, look like? Did it look different? Did you have any indications that cod population was really making its final decline?
Yes, I think we did, particularly in hindsight. Although, you know, at the time, it was kind of difficult because no one really understood what was happening, because like most things, you know, you learn from experience, and we had no experience like that before. The decline was so rapid that it really took everybody off guard. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, even all these years later, we really don't have the perfect explanation about what really happened. We know components of it. We know, of course, there was overfishing, and that had been going on for decades. We know that there was tremendous change in the environment and in the ocean climate, and that certainly had an effect. We know that the productivity of the cod stock had been declining. But, you know, putting all that together and kind of coming up with, as we like to do in fishery science, some sort of an explanatory model that would capture all those things and explain the decline, we still really don't have that.
Do you think that we understand enough for scientists and managers here to be able to look at what happened in Newfoundland and say, oh, this looks similar, we could be looking at the same sort of situation?
Yes, I think there are certain symptoms of what happened that, as far as I understand, are quite similar. One thing that we noticed was an extreme contraction of the range of the fish. You know, they kind of, as the decline was taking place, they were moving out of their typical kind of more broad spread range, which for in the Grand Banks and Newfoundland stocks, you know, it covers hundreds and hundreds of nautical miles. It's you know, this was arguably the biggest stock in the world. It may not have ever been exactly, you know, the biggest one, but it, for the sake of argument, it was very, very large and close to that. Well, you know, the range contracted, the fish moved south, and they ended up where the kind of, they made their last stand 25 years ago, was all in one particular place. And interestingly enough, that's where they're starting to rebuild right now.
It seems that we're seeing something perhaps similar here, and that's one of the points of controversy between scientists and fishermen, is that the fishermen say, well, we're going out and we're still able to catch cod. And the scientists say, well, that's because you're going to these places where they're clumping. And when we look more broadly, that's when we start to see the decline. You know, there's a lack of understanding there between the two communities about how to look at this and really understand what's happening with the fish themselves.
Well, I think that's quite right, you know, and that was the experience that we had with our fisheries in Newfoundland and Labrador during the decline. You know, if you look at we had two kind of distinct fisheries. We had the offshore fishery, which was basically a large boat trawler fishery, and the inshore fishery, which was a combination of gears but prosecuted almost exclusively from smaller vessels. And in the southern area of the range of the northern cod stock, the catch rates were the highest they ever had been as the stock declined. And, you know, the reason for that was because of this, what I call, I published a paper a long time ago. Geez, it was in the, probably 15, 20 years ago. I can't remember the exact date, but it was in the mid-90s that called this hyper-aggregation, where the fish would, as they were declining, were hyper-aggregating. And of course, fishing catch rates depend on aggregation. They don't depend on overall biomass. And that's exactly, that's well recorded and well understood now from our stock, and that very well could be what is happening now in the Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank system.
Did you expect Newfoundland cod to recover within, say, 5 years or a relatively short period of time?
No, definitely not. In fact, myself and colleagues published a paper way back in 1993 where we, and it wasn't a very popular paper at the time, I can tell you, but we thought, because of the massive changes that had taken place, that it would take decades before we could expect recovery. There were other points of view, and there were other scientific papers that thought, well, it was just overfishing, which, you know, we never thought it was, and I think that's been borne out. It wasn't just simply overfishing. But if you took the line that it was, then all you have to do is remove the fishing and things would rebound at a very quick rate. And there are papers published in the 90s which said that, but that's been disproven completely because of the length of time it's taken. It really took about two decades before we started to see some major improvements in our cod stocks. And we are seeing them now, which is, you know, another thing that's controversial. Many people thought that was it. It was over. The cod would never come back. But they are, and we'll see what happens. But a lot of this is, you know, depends on Mother Nature and the environment, and we've got climate change going on, which I'm sure is having a big, big effect on what you're seeing in the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank. And, you know, that's something which we don't have a good track record of prediction on, so it's difficult to say with any certainty.
Isn't it possible that even if it were just overfishing, which it's clearly not just overfishing, clearly climate change is an issue, but even if it were just overfishing, wouldn't it be possible to fish the populations down to a point where recovery is not possible, a point of no return?
You know, I don't know, you know, an absolute answer to that. It seems highly unlikely. Commercial fishing would probably become very unprofitable, you know, before that would happen. It wouldn't go to an absolute biological extinction. But, you know, the problem is that these cod stocks in particular, the way they evolved was to be numerous. And when we take them down to a very, very low level, really all bets are off as to how they're going to perform. They're going to have to kind of reinvent their whole life history and how they relate to the environment and how they reproduce and where they go and what they eat and all the rest of it. We've been watching this now for 25 years in Newfoundland and Labrador waters, and I think we've learned an awful lot about how they do this. And we're convinced now that they can do this, but it takes a lot of time and a lot of protection. You know, we've protected our cod stocks more or less. There's small takes from them, but we've protected them for 25 years to get this result.
Are you optimistic about the future of Newfoundland cod at this point?
Yes, very much so. I think that you know, we're kind of at a new beginning where it looks like some of our stocks, anyway, could really take off in the near future. Now, you know, a lot of the fisheries and a lot of the fishermen are not very happy about this because there's what we got in our ecosystem when the cod declined was huge increases in crustaceans, very lucrative crustaceans, shrimp and snow crab, And so that has carried the fishery and been a very, very lucrative fishery for the last 20 years. And those stocks are now declining, again, probably because of, mostly because of changes in the environment. And, you know, as they are declining, the cod and the capelin, the more traditional fin fish, are increasing. So massive changes are going on. But, you know, when it really comes down to is basic productivity in the ocean. That's what we need to protect. And we still have that in our waters. And as long as we have that, you know, the ocean is going to produce something of value, particularly, we hope, of value to human society. But it will certainly be something that will be numerous in a very productive system.
Yeah, I guess another parallel there, we've seen huge increases in Gulf of Maine lobster in recent years, and one of the hypotheses has been lack of predation from groundfish. So,
yeah, I think that's, you know, it's an important factor. But I think, you know, even further down the food chain, the evidence from Newfoundland and Labrador and the Grand Banks over the last 20 years is changes in the whole food chain are probably the most important thing. Other than, you know, our effects, the human effects of fishing and in some cases pollution. But if you take away the human effects, the effects coming up the food chain, right from the plankton, are incredibly important. That's one of the things that we have learned. You know, the old fisheries models that we all knew and loved and used for a long, long time, most of which have failed us, by the way, took nothing like this into account. They took fish stocks were only influenced by humans. There was no influence by the environment or by climate or by, you know, what was going on in the plankton food chain. But I think we kind of understand now that, you know, that doesn't work. We really have to understand what's going on in the whole fisheries ecosystem to really be able to predict what's going to happen. And I think there's been a lot of progress made on the scientific front in that regard, but it's we're still early in the game in claiming that we can really understand what's going on in the ocean fully.
Absolutely true. All right, well, Dr. Rose, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome, and good luck with it. And I'll try to follow this as much as I can because, of course, interested in the fisheries, particularly in cod fisheries, and that's an interesting one. It's an old fishery, and we wish it the best. But given the changes in climate that are taking place, it's probably going to be a tough goal for cold water species like cod.
That's George Rose, head of the Fisheries Conservation Group at Memorial University in Newfoundland. As Dr. Rose alluded to, the long history of cod fishing is now being compounded by climate change and other ecological shifts. Together, it paints a grim picture for the future of one of New England's most iconic species. What would we lose if cod were no longer fished in New England? Share your thoughts with Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.